Today, is Australia at risk of jumping the shark? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of those posts covering finance and property news. The slang term jumping the shark is, according to the Urban Dictionary, when somebody has reached its peak and begun a downhill slide to mediocrity or oblivion. It was especially applied to TV shows, like the Happy Days episode where Fonzie steps over a shark while on water skis. This was considered to be the low point of the show's multi-year run. But it's also applicable to what's happening in Australia just now, as according to the latest economic data, we're teetering on the brink of falling back into another per capita recession. The data released as part of the national accounts this week by the ABS showed Australia's economy inched forward by just 0.2% over the first 3 months of the year. It means quarterly growth slowed in the first 3 months from 0.6% at the end of 2024. And missed expectations. Over the year to March 31, economic activity increased by just 1.3%. Now, of course, over both the past quarter and the past year, Australia's population grew much faster than its economy. As a result, on a per-person basis, economic output was 0.4% less than it was a year ago. Actually, economic growth has failed to keep up with population growth for 9 of the past 11 quarters. Or to put another way, Australia now produces 1.7% less than it did around 3 years ago. There was a rise in disposable income, driven by a 1.5% growth in compensation of employees' wages, salaries, and employers' social contributions. But that was partially offset by more income tax payable. The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away, to quote poor old Job. Today, there are more jobs and lower unemployment in Australia than at almost any time in the past 50 years, partly due to the expansion of the government-dominated care sector. But this is not translating into forward momentum. Households with mortgages did benefit from lower interest payments following the RBA's cash rate cut in February, and household spending is relatively slow in the March quarter, following stronger than usual spending during the December quarter's retail sales events. This chimes with data from our household surveys, which continues to show large numbers of people remaining trapped in a cash flow doom loop. You can check this out in my earlier show for details of this. The public sector detracted from growth in the March quarter, down 0.1 percentage points, with large declines in public investment and no growth in government spending. Net trade also detracted from growth, down 0.1 percentage points due to reduced exports of goods and services, partially offset by a fall in imports. Private demand drove the growth up 0.3 percentage points, and that helped to keep GDP positive overall, but it was still weaker in the March quarter than the December quarter. Digging into the private sector data, private investment actually rose by a decent 0.7% in the March quarter, led by investment in dwellings, new buildings and new engineering construction. Dwellings investment surged by 2.6%. That's the strongest result in 4 years, and the ABS said investment in both houses and alterations and additions grew in line with recent increases in approvals. Non-dwelling construction investment also grew by a solid 1.7%, although it was largely offset by a 1.7% fall in machinery and equipment investment. So let's see, the housing sector seems to be being stoked again to try and help the economy. I wonder why that is. In its latest economic statement, the Reserve Bank forecast annual GDP growth of 1.8% by the end of the June quarter, picking up to 2.1% by the end of this year. That's a downgrade from its previous forecast following the Trump administration's shock tariff announcements in April. It means the economy will have to grow noticeably in the June quarter to meet that annual target. As to why the GDP measure fell, well, Cyclone Alfred brought great disruption and damage to heavily populated areas of southeast Queensland and northern New South Wales. Perhaps the repair jobs to fix that damage will add to GDP over the current and incoming quarters. Next, until now, strong public sector spending growth has been keeping the economy afloat, but this time there was no growth in its spending and a decline in investment as a number of major infrastructure projects were either completed or put on hold. This begs the question, will private sector investment rise, set against the global trade uncertainty? Now, it's true that public spending has tended to crowd out the private sector, but will that now stop, and will the private sector pick up the slack? And thirdly, population growth, which is another driver of a bigger bottom line, may be slowing, but trying to get a handle on migration is a lottery, as the Australian Bureau of Statistics population data has become, well, complicated, as the ABS data compared with the population estimates in the national accounts differs wildly from the official quarterly population statistics released a few weeks later. The Q1 25 national accounts released on Wednesday implied that Australia's population growth accelerated to 121,200 in the first quarter, but the national accounts suggest that Australia's national population slowed from 484,000 in the third quarter 24, that's the latest official figures, to 459,300 in the first quarter of 2025. So as a result, the rate of population growth is implied to have fallen from 1.8% in the third quarter of 2024 to 1.7% in the first quarter of 2025. Now, I don't have much faith in these figures, and they could easily be revised later. Remember, the latest labour force release suggests that Australia's population grew by 0.65% in 3 months to April, equating to a population increase of 147,000 people, or an annualised rate of around 588,000, while the annual rate of growth in the 15-plus population also ticked up to 2.1%, or 471,000 in April, according to the Labour Force survey. Actually, CBA produced a chart to highlight the differences between the measures. My own suspicion is population growth via migration remains stronger than assumed in the latest numbers, meaning that per capita pressure could well be even stronger. Now, there was a rise in income, but households are saving where they can, not spending. From historical peaks above 20% during COVID, when stimulus payments collided with the physical inability to get out and spend the dough, the household savings ratio plunged to a low of just 1.5% in September 2023. That was the lowest since December 2007, as households chewed into their savings to cope with high interest rates and a surging cost of living. But the savings rate has rebounded from that low. In the March quarter, it rose to 5.2%, which is roughly back to where it was immediately before COVID. So the question is, will future income growth, including the recent minimum and award wage decision, be channeled into household consumption? Well, we'll see. But again, my survey suggests an unequal distribution of potential spending power, which suggests any uptick in consumption might be a bit anemic. An ongoing squeeze on some households from restrictive interest rate levels, along with some caution in the face of US President Donald Trump's tariff wars and the associated financial market volatility, could well crimp household spending ahead. Commentators actually have been quick to look to the RBA to cap the cash rate again, given the soft demand data and the economy losing momentum. So possibly the RBA will cut its July meeting to help boost growth, but the monthly inflation report from April does add some uncertainty. While headline inflation was steady at 2.4% over the year to April, underlying measures did tick higher. The monthly rate, excluding volatile items such as fuel and fresh food, rose to 2.8%. That's up from 2.6%, which suggests that price pressures are becoming a bit more widespread. So these mixed signals leave the RBA facing a delicate balancing act. Upcoming data, particularly the employment report on June the 19th and the main monthly inflation indicator on June 25th, will be critical in determining whether inflation is easing enough to justify another cut or showing signs of persistence that calls for caution in the light of, quote, uncertainty. Financial markets, though, are pricing in a greater than 80% chance the RBA will cut interest rates in July, with about a 70% chance of a follow-up cut in August. The odds of the RBA cutting rates sooner rather than later have been boosted by the dour global economic outlook, clouded, of course, by Trump's tariff policies and generally erratic policymaking. Having avoided falling off what successive RBA governors have described as a narrow path of reducing inflation without spiking unemployment, it would be ironic if the bank was too slow to recognise the latest bend in the economy and blithely walk right over the edge. But that inflation risk is real as we wander into the stagflation zone. As Assistant Governor Sarah Hunter said recently, Australia is unlikely to be directly hit by Donald Trump's tariffs, but global uncertainty may cause weaker growth and labour markets. This risk has been exacerbated by global uncertainties relating to US trade policy, which has weighed on confidence and the willingness to invest and spend, without a material pickup in private demand, the economy could be set for a period of subdued growth. But given Australia's close trade ties with China, any sustained slowdown there poses a clear risk to export earnings and broader economic growth. Together, those global headwinds are adding to the uncertainty surrounding Australia's economic outlook. The OECD released its latest Global Economic Outlook report and cut its global growth forecast for this year from 3.1% to 2.9%, with no improvement expected next year. Today's policy uncertainty is weakening trade and investment, diminishing consumer and business confidence, and curbing growth prospects, the organisation's Secretary-General and former Australian Finance Minister Matthias Cormann said. But Treasurer Jim Chalmers said that, quote, the Australian economy remains one of the strongest in the world, but at the moment, there's little to write home about, in my view. The key issue is actually productivity. Australian productivity has been unchanged over the past two quarters and remains more than 5% below its peak. Meanwhile, the lingering effects of previous inflation and real wage declines are to take at least until the end of this decade to repair, even if nothing goes wrong in the meantime. National accounts show the economy faced longer-term structural issues too. Weak business investment has been stuck between 11 and 15% of GDP over the past decade and suggests that tax and regulatory settings are holding back innovation and also probably foreign interest in investing in Australia. The Productivity Commission's current work on how to boost productivity growth through creating a dynamic and resilient economy, as well as through other pillars, should be adopted with enthusiasm by the Albanese government, but we'll see about that. As expected, Jim Chalmers put lipstick on a pig, spruiking that the private sector recovery we have planned and prepared for is gradually taking hold. Well, there's a pig just gone past the window there. The Australian economy remains one of the strongest in the world, Chalmers said via a media release. No major advanced economy has achieved what we have, with unemployment in the low fours, inflation below 2.5% and continuous growth for 3 years. While the private sector-led recovery was always going to be gradual, today's data shows encouraging signs that it's continuing. Private demand grew 0.5%, contributing 0.3% to growth in the quarter. Getting real income growing again has been central to our government's economic strategy after they were going backwards, 1.7% when we came to office. Real incomes per capita grew 1.1% in the quarter and are up 1.7% through the year. This is the strongest quarterly growth for real incomes in more than 3 years, Chalmers said. Now, with regard to the Fair Work Commission, I don't think the 3.5% annual minimum wage rise increase will make the sky fall in, but unless labour productivity growth recovers from a lost decade, higher wages costs will simply be imposed on businesses and ultimately passed on to consumers. Productivity is going backwards in the non-market government sector, such as healthcare, aged care, disability support, and public administration. This is where federal and state governments have been spending huge amounts of taxpayer dollars and where much of the economy's job creation has been since the pandemic. These trends undermine Jim Chalmers' hopes for a gear change from government spending-led growth to private sector-led growth. And to make workers more productive, businesses need to invest in new tools, equipment and technology. Only then can businesses afford to pay sustainably high real wage increases and can living standards durably improve. But business investment edged up just 0.1% in the March quarter and a soft 0.8% through the year. Most of those gains were due to an investment lift in buildings, mining and energy projects. Investment in machinery and equipment, such as technology, actually fell 1.7% in the quarter and has declined 3.7% over the past year. These are the very tools businesses need to get into the hands of workers to make them more productive. It's just not happening. The uncertainty caused by Donald Trump's trade war is actually likely to further hamper the confidence of businesses to invest. Forward-looking capital spending surveys suggest that sluggish business investment growth is likely in the next 12 months, according to AMP. The weakness in productivity is a problem for the economy in the long run because it means lower living standards. Chancellor Chief Economist Jonathan Kearns said the weakness in productivity growth constrains the RBA from cutting rates too aggressively. With productivity falling over the past year and no cumulative growth over 5 years, the still too high growth in unit labour costs, adjusted for changes in productivity, remains too high. And Treasurer Jim Chalmers' hope of the economy transferring from rampant government spending to business-led growth is really on shaky ground. Government spending cannot be relied on to deliver sustainable growth to improve people's living standards. But business investment as a share of the economy is near the lows of the early 1990s recession. So therefore, there should be no surprise that there's been almost no productivity growth in the past decade. That's a problem because better ways of producing the same output with fewer inputs accounts for more than 80% of national income growth over the past 30 years. That's according to the Productivity Commission. Getting more tools, technology, and equipment into workplaces will make workers more productive through what economists call capital deepening. Yet, Australia has a chronic capital shallowing problem. This has now been called out in the OECD report. In fact, the OECD estimates that Australia is suffering from a staggering 30% shortfall in business investment relative to economic output. That puts Australia in the third worst position in the rich club that the OECD represents. So the OECD urged the federal and state governments to repair their budgets as new data showed record growth in welfare spending while business investment languishes near four-decade lows, highlighting Treasurer Jim Chalmers' challenge to spur a private sector-led economic recovery. The release of the OECD's report came as the Fair Work Commission awarded a pay increase of 3.5% to 2.6 million workers on minimum award rates. The largest above-inflation wage increase since 2019 sparked an outcry from business groups who claimed that it would force them to cut back even further on investment. AMP Chief Economist Shane Oliver said he did not expect the increase to drive up inflation because companies appeared to be absorbing extra costs in their profits. But he cautioned that recent figures showing the lowest business investment as a share of the economy in at least 40 years was consistent with slow productivity and did not bode well for turning it around. Treasury Secretary Stephen Kennedy said last week that the Albanese government had invested in the social compact over the past 3 years, including addressing pay inequalities in feminized industries and health and education outcomes. He said the focus would shift in the second term of government to lifting productivity, including by increasing competition to increase business to invest more, including in technology such as AI. But unless there is significant shifts in gears, it looks to me as if we've entered the stagflation twilight zone. And policy settings simply won't allow things to change as we've begun a downhill slide to mediocrity or even oblivion. As I discussed with Leif Van Onselen on Tuesday, there are routes out of this mess. But the question is, are our leaders up to it? In my view, probably not. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.